Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hope you are all well, witches. It is that random time between Christmas and New Year when no one has a Scooby what day of the week it is, where they are. You wake up from a nap on the sofa thinking it's 1992 and you're about to miss your school bus. You're so confused. That may just be me. But I hope you all enjoyed the festive season, whatever you've been celebrating, and wish you all a happy New Year. I haven't got a book review for you today, I'm afraid, but I certainly will for our next episode. Today's episode is a long one still, as we really got into it in an interview that I did with the wonderful Amanda Edmiston, the author of The Time Traveller's Herbal. Join me after the break to talk all about the historical apothecary cabinet. Welcome back. I am here with Amanda Edmiston. She is a herbalist and storyteller based in Scotland. She first learned about plants and recipes from her grandmother, who still remembered traditional remedies and folklore. After studying law and then herbal medicine, Amanda found it natural to start bringing together stories, plants, and magical places, drawing on the Scottish storytelling tradition, but in her own unique way. She has been showcasing her own work for over 10 years, performing and creating art in museums, libraries, forests, castles, schools, and universities around the world under the banner Botanica Fabula. Welcome to the show, Amanda.
Hi, Carly. Thank you so much for inviting me on. It's lovely to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you here, especially because I'm reading your, beautiful, amazing book, The Time Traveller's Herbal. This is, honestly, I'm so impressed with your work. It's absolutely stunning.
Thank you so much. I really like you like it, genuinely.
It's just so gorgeous, like the aesthetic, and I mean not just the aesthetic, you know, the images in it are stunning. It's just such an oldie worldy feeling grimoire. It's just kind of what you would hope that, you know, it kind of looks like something you would have been passed down by your grandmother. It's just absolutely stunning. But the information in it, oh my goodness, as somebody who's got a real love of folklore, herbs, and the old ways, there is so much I found in here that I have not found elsewhere in other books or like research I've done. So honestly, you've done good.
Thank you so much. And do you know what, I mean, it was a long time before it arrived. When I was doing book launches the other week, one of the places that I was, the big sort of party launch, if you like, was at the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons in Glasgow. And wow. It was the one I giggled at most, because I had friends that I'd known for 40 plus years. So one of my best friends from school came along, and I haven't seen her for a while. There were friends from toddler groups that I went to 16 years ago with my eldest. There were people from sort of all my walks of life.
Yeah.
And I got nervous, which I don't do very often. I mean, I've been a storyteller for 14 years, as you said in my bio. And I got the giggles, but it was really lovely. And what I kind of wanted to tell them most was that sort of my magic, my dream had come true, where somebody had been listening to my storytelling and spotted this way that I work, which combines social history, folklore, fairy tales, legends, mythology, how we use plants, the symbolic importance of those plants within the stories, and then blends them all together and reshares them. Someone had spotted that, seen it for what it was, and commissioned me to write a book. So really, I'm so glad that the book makes you feel like that, because it really feels like creating it was one of my childhood dreams coming true. So thank you.
Oh, I love that so much. No, you should be so proud, honestly. And coming to that, can you talk us through like the very beginning of your relationship with herbs, like how your relationship looks like with them today and the work that you do with them?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we might, how long have you got? We might be here for days. I'm a storyteller, I'm a chatterbox. It might take me months. I guess what I say in the book, that one of my earliest memories is with being with my gran in her kitchen in Aberdeen, which is, you know, it's sometimes called the Silver City, but it's made of granite. And granite is a somewhat overwhelming stone. It's very grey on a dull day, but sometimes when the sunshine catches it after rain, it shines silver. But my gran's kitchen was this warm, warm, cozy sort of golden hob in this huge granite house. And her cooking had a sort of almost mesmerizing alchemical effect, I guess, on me. But she also had this beautiful garden, and she would take me into the garden and get me touching plants from a, you know, as a toddler. I must have only been 2 years old, of holding sort of clove scented pink, you know, and that beautiful strong scent, and collecting mint to go on potatoes, or chives to garnish a salad, or, you know, so herbs and plants and cooking and the sort of integration of the garden into the kitchen was something I grew up with. And my grandfather was a sculptor, and would tell me stories about the landscape and about the trees that he was, you know, that he had wood that he was then carving, or the stone he was carving, the places it had been. And although my mum wasn't a storyteller when I was first born, she was a textile artist, something she's returned to later in life, or she was soon to become a textile artist in those days. My mum was always a storyteller too, and she would tell me stories about her own childhood when she went with my grandparents to my gran's mum and dad, my great-grandparents, who had a farm in the Worcestershire countryside, and the sort of incredible memories and the history and how that had shifted was always woven into my mum's stories. So I guess my own sort of development was always there. My contact with herbs, wood with my grandfather, stories and social history with my mum, and my gran's cooking. You know, my mum's a wonderful cook too. And just the recipe books. I mentioned my gran's recipe book that she was given by her mother-in-law, my great-grandmother, and how this book seemed almost enchanted when I was growing up. It felt so old, you know, the paper is thick, and slightly yellowing, and there are generational notes in the margins, and there's still a smell of my gran's kitchen attached to that book. So I feel like it was always there. How that translated into my current practice with plants, I got lost for a bit. Made some poor choices in terms of careers and relationships and lifestyle and all those other elements that sometimes become a sort of shadow zone in your late teens and early 20s. Took myself off from a very difficult situation to study herbal medicine and return to Scotland. And my mum decided she would move up too. She'd been a storyteller by this point for about 14 or 15 years. And she, you know, we both came back to Scotland, having my mum grew up here, and I spent the first few years of my life up here and had studied here and other things. Yeah, so we came back up here and I decided I would formally study herbal medicine. Something which, if you read the book, you will find out was not to be. I decided not to go into clinical practice, but decided that for me, sharing stories about the plants, and specifically stories that tell us the real use of plants, which so many stories do. I allude to Rapunzel in one chapter, and mentioned the earlier Italian version, which concerns parsley in the place of Rapunzels. And parsley, if you craved parsley as a pregnant woman, it might be because you had iron deficient anemia, for example, because parsley is massively rich in iron. But it's also capable of bringing the birthing process on. You know, we advise women not to eat huge amounts of parsley in pregnancy. Certainly don't use it medicinally. But if you were at the very, very end, the last few days of an otherwise healthy pregnancy, you know, a bit of parsley might speed things up a bit. It's quite powerful. And I think that's really sort of poetic, if you like, that there are these fairy tales and the herbs seem like such a small part of it, but they're whispering through time of what they were used for and of knowledge that people have had. So for me now, my practice is about gathering social history, anecdotal stories, and little snippets of folklore, usually in community settings, and just by conversation and a bit of archive research, spotting how those plants are being used, looking at folklore that's integral to the landscape and the plants that then grow where those stories and histories are set, and combining the two. So I share the stories like I do in the book. I also create performance pieces, workshops. I've just branched out into an online course because people have said, there's a load more information there. I know, I've seen your show, I've read the book. What about the rest of it? I know you know more. And I've gone, okay, I will create an online course. So that's happening too. But the whole time I'm doing that, I also have my own quite personal practice where I gather herbs in the places the stories are set in, make tinctures, dry them to share when I'm creating performances, or, you know, people that have ordered the book from me direct are getting personally chosen packages of herbs with the book. I've got herbs going out with the course. Yeah, they're all there. Basically, the herbs are constantly there. But as you've just gathered in my lengthy explanation, they weave into that social history. They are part of the landscape. They're not just thrown in there casually. The whole thing has to layer itself up and there has to be a reason for things. I like things to develop reason. I've got, in fact, in front of me today, I've got, if you've read the, when you're reading the book, you'll discover Hertha's Haunt, which is a meadow not far from where I live, and the meadow sweet and valerian that are in two chapters of the book became Hertha's Meadow Queen, which is a sleepy tincture of meadow sweet and valerian in brandy, but it's actually one of the two of the chapters and the herbs. And the other one I've got in front of me at the moment is a very special individual course that I ran for a wonderful student of mine. But we went to the Ring of Brodgar in Orkney, and we have created a special tincture in a very exclusive Orkney whiskey with herbs from the Ring of Brodgar that go with the story that we wrote while we were working up there. So yeah, that's what I do.
Wow.
That's what I
do. Yeah. You are such a storyteller. Like, I find myself hanging on your every word, so I can absolutely understand why you didn't go down the clinical route and like stuck to doing this, because you're such a people person, honestly. Like, you're so warm, and you know, when we first started talking, we're just gassing away because you're so down to earth. And yeah, I feel like you're definitely doing exactly what you're meant to be doing with this. One thing I, oh my goodness, love about the book is that you take the reader through different periods of time with herbs and their lore. Is there a specific period in history that you are particularly drawn to? And if so, are there any reasons why?
In many ways, I have to be honest, I am really hoping that the Time Travelers Herbal does well, partially because there was so much material. When I say the time spiral speeds up at the end of the book, and that I decided to draw a close to events at the beginning of the 19th century, about 1800 or thereabouts, is because we're just about to leap into my favourite period of history.
Ah, right.
and everything from like Victorian days through to the, I really like the First World and Second World War periods of English history in terms of the memories have been given to me and have been shared by people I've spoken to, my own grandparents' recollections and stories. And just because I know, I don't want to give too much away, but I know how our approach to herbs and using them, and in fact to stories, really shift in the first 40, 50 years of the 20th century. As a child, I was absolutely fascinated by Victoriana. I love the sort of shadowy intrigue of that whole period of history and the poisoning and there's a shadow Time Travelers Herbal lurking in there too, where I just talk about things that have really detrimental effects in the wrong hands. But I also have to say, I mean, this is why I've written a Time Traveler's Herbal, because I just love history. I really feel like I can visualise myself back in time, I guess from the perspective of this book, the first one, I've just alluded to, that I hope there will be a second one that has the next 200 years in it. But in terms of the 2000 years I look at in the Time Traveler's Herbal, I have learned to love over the last few years the 18th century world that I talk about so much. I mean, we had incredible changes going on in Scotland, in Britain, during that period of time. The witch trials are coming to an end, or the first, you know, the first horrors of the witch trials before the law gets changed so that you can only be accused of of impersonating a witch as opposed to actually being a witch, and the sort of burning and the horrors draw to a close. But other things are happening. Plants are coming into the country, and although it's a time of quite a lot of land snatching, culture grabbing, imperial middle class white, usually male. I'm really sorry, middle class white men that are lovely. But some of your historical forebears were not so great for that one.
I concur.
What I mean? But at the same point, there is this incredible shift in knowledge. And when I first crossed paths with Elizabeth Blackwell, who is in that chapter, this pioneering Scotswoman who becomes the first woman in 1737 to write and publish a herbal. And she does it as a single parent because her husband has been put in a debtor's jail. It was her money he spent. And why she has him back, I don't know. But anyway, that's a whole other conversation. But she's fantastic. And she wrote and illustrated this book that has 500 plants from the everyday hedge plants, weeds that you would see breaking through the urban pavement, to exotic things, cocoa and tamarind and wonderful plants. Corals and seaweeds creep in there too. It's just an incredible book. And when I encountered it for the first time in this Royal College that was granted its royal charter by James the Sixth of Scotland, the First of England, who really fueled the fires of those witch trials, there was something magical about the encounter. And over a period of about 3 years working with a curious herbal, I kept crossing this incredible woman's path, and it began to feel like actual magic, like I was caught in some kind of parallel universe and that sparks were flying. And so it felt so close. Our lives seem so intertwined, and the speed I started to learn about certain herbs and stories as I worked with the book and wrote the stories, some of which became the Time Traveller's Herbal, some of which are now in the Curious Herbal online course. It just that drew me in. And so the 18th century, especially the first half of the 18th century, became, an absolute place of wonder for me. That said, you've gone and asked me my favorite question. As I said, we'll be here months. I'm saying that now, and I'm like, yeah, but what's not to love about the 14th century? The 14th century is wonderful. Honestly, I mean, there are so many fascinating characters and so many wonderful herbal stories threaded through the weft of time that it's impossible not to have a little bit of affection for them all.
Oh no, I completely agree with you. There's so many. You know what? I just had chills thinking, maybe Elizabeth Blackwell sees you as the modern version of her, like you're doing the work, or maybe it's a past life thing. It's just really interesting how you were saying about the synchronicity that she kept coming up, like seems very aligned, spookily aligned to me.
It was, and the whole time I was working on the Very Curious Herbal project, I would have these incredible chance encounters. So, I would work with a certain plant, and this was during lockdown and the time following lockdown. And I'd had a really before the year before lockdown, I'd had cancer. I hadn't talked about it a great deal because I didn't want it to impact on my work, and I didn't want to give up. And I was just keeping going. But there'd been a lot of personal tragedy as well that year in other aspects of my life, and a lot of complications. And I took the whole Very Curious Herbal project online because I was meant to be taking it to the British Library, but that got cancelled with COVID. And then I was meant to be going to Chawton House Museum down in Hampshire, and that got cancelled. And I thought, I'm just going to keep going. I need something to connect me and the herbs and my storytelling together through this. And I did a plant at a time. Sometimes it lasted a week, sometimes it lasted a month. And I did little online bits for people to join in with. And every time I picked a plant, that plant would cause something peculiar and significant to happen. I mean, really silly stuff. At one point I was working with Holly, and I'd had an online meeting with someone about possible future event, and she phoned up to chat because we'd had to cancel it. And we got on so well that she became a really good friend. We're still really good friends now. We've been on holiday together, and it's, you know, she's fab, but she's called Holly, and she arrived when I was doing Holly. Holly appeared during Holly. The other one was hilarious and completely silly. You know, I mean, people expect magic to be, you know, deep and meaningful. Sometimes it's just daft. And you see it, you know. But if you see it, it helps you feel like there's something wonderful and different happening in the universe. So the other one was the day I started to work on the cucumber chapter. Now, cucumbers are wonderful. They've got an amazing history. They've changed dynasties. They were once used for quite successfully, I believe, for fertility. Although that aspect has kind of been removed from them in mass supermarket selling because they're now seedless, and it's the seeds that... Anyway, I could go on about cucumbers for ages. But the day I started cucumbers in the Curious Herbal Project, I went to collect my online supermarket order in a main British UK, you know, as everyday and normal as you like, the most normal British supermarket there is. You know, for the listeners in the UK, I was getting a multi-pack of pants in the same order. You know where I was. You couldn't get a less magical place, right? And the woman said to me, oh, on your reward card, you get a free cucumber. Would you like me to go and get it and pack it for you? And I was like, what? And she went, people usually get a box of biscuits or chocolate or something like that. For some reason, you've got a cucumber. And I'm like, okay, I'll take that. That's fine. Like, that's really odd. And I just came home and I wrote about it, you know, on my social media. I'm like, this is really odd. I'm doing cucumber this week. As you all know, I announced it yesterday. I've just been to insert boring supermarket experience. And the woman's come rushing out and said, oh, I forgot to give you your free cucumber. And I'm like, what?
Oh, that's so cool.
So even with your, even, you know, with your 2 pints of milk and your apples and your potatoes and your vital whatever and your 5-pack of pants, you get a free cucumber if you practice magic in the right way.
I know exactly what supermarket I think you're talking about, and that just is such a random thing. She's right. It's normally like biscuits or something that's got a bit more,
isn't it?
A bit more, yeah. A bit more attractive. Cucumber, but the universe moves in mysterious ways.
Just looked at it. She kept looking at the order on her iPad or whatever it is, going, what? She said, I've never seen a free cucumber before. And I'm like,
oh,
I'm not surprised.
I love it. I love that you've got your own stories on this as well, but I did want to ask you, so yeah. Throughout the book, you delve into lore associated with herbs and plants, and, you know, so what is a story that you found writing the book that you particularly cherish, and why, and what is that herb or plant?
Probably the story I cherish most. I mean, the Elizabeth Blackwell story from the point of view of being a historical insight into a historical story, if you like, is my favourite. In terms of mythology, legend, fairy tale, it's probably got to be the one in the chapter Moss Lights, which is a story I got told when I was really little by my granddad about a Pictish carved stone, or maybe not, maybe it is created by the devil himself, but it's a story of a stone that is now known as the Maiden Stone. Mm-hmm. And it's in Geary Mill in Aberdeenshire. And it's just a beautiful stone. It feels really special. I go there occasionally when I'm back up that direction, and I have a tendency to talk to her in the first person as if she's real. I feel like she may well be a maiden trapped in a stone. And I love that story. I've told it to so many groups. I've told it to, you know, older school children who always love it. And, you know, the idea of the devil chasing her and capturing her, I won't give too much away. And I love moss because for me, and a lot of people, you know, there are lots of versions of that story, as there usually are with good stories that have an oral tradition. But for me, moss was always a really central part of that story. And because it's so tactile and so wonderful, and so that whole, and it's, and again, it ties into Scottish social history, because, you know, they collected moss for war wounds. And I think moss probably has a lot of hidden remedies within it that we haven't yet discovered. I feel like moss could be Scotland's very own rainforest. Well, we have a rainforest. Mm. I feel like moss, there are so many types of moss. We don't use it very much anymore. I found out lots of magical things about moss when I was working with that story for the chapter. I love moss, and I really love that story. I mean, it's one that when I tell it now, I still get a shiver goes through my body. But again, it's like herbs and periods of history. I've told you that, and I also have to tell you that there was this story about the girl who weaves nettle shirts for her brothers when they're turned into swans, which I only mention in the book. But I did record as a hidden extra in the audio book, if anyone wants to hear it. But it's a story that comes from all different cultures of the world. It's like there are seven different versions that are slightly different from different countries of the same story. And nettles are such an incredible plant. They're wonderful to work with. They've got so many benefits, so many aspects of life and practice that you use nettles for. So that's got to be another story that is a personal favorite, and it's kind of only loosely, it's alluded to, should we say, in the book, because as my editor said at the beginning, she said, I love your version of it, please share it on the audiobook, but you don't need to write it in the book, because I feel like it's riven into people's DNA. Because I think a lot of people, when I mention that story, I don't need to tell it terribly often. I did tell it, if nobody knows it, if people don't know it. But, you know, I almost don't need to mention it. I can just mention the story, and everyone knows the story of the girl weaving the shirt. So that's my other one. Those are probably my top two, the moss maiden and the nettle shirts.
You know, I love this because I think for me, it's a really strange fear that I have that we will stop telling the stories or like forget the stories. And I feel like we have a lot of stories on the show, and, you know, a lot of the work and bits I've done are around the stories as well, because I don't know what it is. I feel like it's such a kind of, I feel like they just have got to keep being retold and, you know, and with our children and so on, they just really feel important to me. And I really felt that with your book, like reading the lore, like I could just tell that, you know, it's really important to you as well.
It is. And I think you've really touched on something vital there. I think stories need to keep being told to stay alive. And I think We don't. But I think a lot of people underestimate how important stories are and how important allowing those stories to keep growing. You know, they're organic. They do take on, you will have done this yourself, I'm sure. You will have told someone a story in a very everyday setting or mentioned a story, and it will have changed. And when you go back to look at a written text, you'll go, oh, that's not the way I remember it at all. And you have allowed that story, that magic spell to be cast on that story that makes it your own. And and somehow by doing that, you've kept it relevant and allowed it to resonate for you and the person listening to it. And in that moment, you've given it a little bit more life, so it stays alive a bit longer and retains that vibrancy. And if we allow stories to grow like that, then they keep their relevance, you know, they keep being these magical things that give us huge amounts of information, huge amounts of comfort, and a great way to connect with other people, and with our sort of ancestors, if you like. Yeah, I mean, you can't underestimate the magic of a story.
No, and I think that you and I touched on this before we came on to recording this interview, that you and I were talking a bit about our stories, and then you've referenced the stories that your mum told you about her life. And, you know, I feel like we don't always realise, because I'll sort of talk to my daughter about stories in the family and so on, and I've been very conscious of keeping those going, and you don't always realize like which bits stick with somebody. So there's bits, there are little stories I've told her, and they are the ones that she's remembered over ones that I kind of thought that she might have been more interested in. You know, sometimes surprises you, yeah, the story that people retain, because there's something in it that just appeals to them and is aligned with them. I love what you said as well about, you know, keeping like a light in those stories, like an energy in them, you know, that they can keep growing and carry on. But yeah, I feel like even just us telling our children or people around us just our own stories, because our whole lives are stories, even, you know, our, you know, not just our ancestors, just our stories as well. And I saw this quote the other day, and it was like, stories are so integral to us, we even dream in stories, you know, we go to sleep and there's still stories being told in our sleep. So they're just so important, I think. They're just so vital.
Exactly. And, you know, I absolutely. And what you've said there about telling your daughter stories or listening to family stories yourself is, most children, if they've had a storytelling kind of family, people that relate their anecdotes back to their children, those are the stories that stay with you for life, that you remember. They're one of the most, I don't know, they're just a really lovely learning process. It's how you learn about being a person, isn't it? By those stories. And usually most children will say that the stories their grandparents or parents told them about when they were little are the ones they remember the longest and they love the best. You know, I mean, the other thing, there's a wonderful storyteller, Alida Gersey, who, you know, she's a veteran of storytelling. But she was one of my mum's mentors. And Alida says in a book that stories offer us a safe place to look at things. And I think for me, that's one of the most important things stories do, is you can reflect on things that are really difficult when they happen to somebody else in a story. And sometimes if that's your mum or your granny, and there's a little bit of personal history there too, that becomes even more powerful. But you don't need to live necessarily that experience. You can understand it and look at it from the safe place that stories give you. And so, yeah, I mean, they're a wonderful thing, you know. And it was lovely. Yeah, it was lovely sort of that shared personal story that we had at the beginning. I think it's made this interview a lot more fun, really. So personal stories do work a bit of magic.
I find that so interesting what you said about the safety aspect, because I find one thing I found really fascinating when I was a kid, my granddad used to, the minute me and my brother used to get to their house, he would like talk to us about stories, and they were often about his experiences out in Burma in like the Second World War and all these countries he went to, and he worked on like ships as like a sort of chef and so on. But my dad never heard any of the stories. We would tell my dad the stories of like, oh, granddad said this, because it was too close in terms of a lot of trauma and so on. So my granddad couldn't tell it in my dad's lifetime, yet we got to experience it, because I guess the time was removed and he'd done a lot of his own healing and could comfortably talk about it. So sometimes maybe it might be that there are certain stories that we might have with our grandchildren, or, you know, further generations, because it's too close to home right now. We're still on our journey of healing and so on. But I found that really interesting that my granddad was so determined to tell us these stories, but they'd missed the generation because it was too close.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's brilliant. You know, you've just sent a shiver through me, because where one of the book launch events, I said, I mentioned, someone was asking about my grandmother sharing sort of little bits about magic to me. I mean, talking about fairies hiding in the garden. And my mum even says, she didn't talk about things like that. That's like almost like you're talking about a different person. I can't imagine her talking about anything that imaginary. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. She's very much a practical human woman, my granny. And absolutely, I get that. Absolutely practical. But there was something else. And then a member of the audience turned to me and said, it's because you were just a child, and you and she wasn't the first in line to be responsible for you. So she could be something slightly different. You know, grandparents are slightly different with their grandchildren than they are with their children. And you know that, and I thought, do you know what? She's right. That's absolutely true. I listened to my mum with my own children, and I'm left going, sometimes I wish she'd be more like she was with me, you know? Yeah. I'm like, why are you doing that? Oh my goodness. You've gone into granny mode. But also, yeah, she shares different things in a different way, and there's something magical and important about that. And I love that your granddad shared his memories of the war and his experiences and adventure. I mean, my granddad would tell me about some of his as well. And again, I think there were questions. People were, did that actually happen? And I'm like, I'm pretty sure it did. He'd just not told anyone else before. You know, so I think that's really important. And I think because I do work with schools as a, you know, professional storyteller, and I take plants in and I get kids mixing up potions that are part of the stories. But one of the things I like to do in my school sessions is incorporate those story collecting sessions that I run in communities and get older people to share their stories with children, because I often say to the kids, if you've moved, and we do move a lot more these days, we often live far away from our grandparents, go and ask the older, you know, the older lady in the shop, an elderly neighbour, ask them about what their childhood was like, because those intergenerational stories are incredibly valuable. And I kind of wanted to bring that into the book, because a lot of the folklore, a lot of the recipes and things like that that I share in the book, although they are centered in a period of history, I've often been told them or taught them through intergenerational story sharing, really. Even like the wonderful curator at the Ashmolean, who creeps mysteriously into one chapter, you know, recipes and things like that, bits of folklore are often shared intergenerationally. And I think that's a really, really, really important way of learning and just It gives us something wonderful to talk to older folk about as well, do you know? I think everyone, regardless of age, should find an older friend sometimes and say, what do you remember about this? How was this, you know, when you were growing up? Just because they're vital to remember.
Absolutely. And I feel like it's, you know, and also for us just to not think, I think sometimes we have this like, oh, they won't want to hear it, or I don't know if they'll want to know. But I think, you know, we must never underestimate how powerful our stories are, or listening to our parents and so on. You know, I feel like people do want to pass some of these on, and I think there's just sometimes this assumption that our children won't want to hear it, or our grandchildren won't. And you'll be surprised, you know, I'm always surprised at bits that my daughter retains, and I'm like, oh, did that really interest you? And she's like, yeah. And sometimes at the time you're telling them it and you don't get much of a reaction. You don't often with children sometimes, or especially teenagers, but you'll be surprised at how much they do retain or has stayed with them. So it is worth, you know, continuing to do.
Absolutely. So, and what I'm picking up, sorry, I just need to say something because you've just made me think of something lovely, that the opposite of your grandparents sharing stories with you that they may not have told their own children, by reflection sort of thing, actually I watch children being like my own children being told things by their grandparents, my father-in-law, or, you know, my late mother-in-law, bless her, showing my eldest how to darn socks. Now, if I told my eldest how to darn socks when she was 13, right, that conversation would have been really brief.
Yeah.
I can't claim that I would be, you know, charming, benevolent and engaging during it. I would have been like, right, this is a thing you're going to learn to do, get a needle and thread, come on, so pay attention now, you've got to do this. And she would have thought that everything I said was really boring and annoying, quite rightly. It would have been quite boring and quite annoying. My late mother-in-law, you know, she sat down and listened and paid.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Paid attention and remembers, bless her, how to darn socks because her grandma told her. So, you know, the other thing is that sometimes those stories told by grandparents or by older folk in the community are much more interesting than if they're told to you by your parents.
Yeah. Oh, so spot on. Absolutely. Because, no, honestly, my daughter goes off to make cheesecake with my dad regularly. And I'm always like, I always kind of just thought, like, she's just doing it because she wants to eat the cake. But the conversations they have, like, she comes away from it. And, you know, same like you, if I was trying to have a conversation with her and make a cheesecake, one of us is going to die. You know, we're going to end up killing each other in the kitchen. But they tend to come away from it with something to eat at the end of it. And she's full of stories. And you're right. Sometimes that gap is just everything for them to be receptive and open. And really, absolutely. Really good point.
So the answer to this is, I didn't think I would be the person to say that, but now I'm thinking that, oh, I need grandchildren, because then they will listen to me.
Absolutely. absolutely. Yeah, I'm going to bore my grandchildren to death if I have stories. Yeah, no, I'm only joking. But I'm really looking forward to, I'll be there with all my fairy tale books and some of my more PG stories of my own to tell them. There's a lot we won't get into, but there'll be a few we can talk about.
Perfect. I think that's valuable for everyone.
Yeah, we'll go with the PG personal stories.
Oh, do you know something? I think having spoken to you before, I think yours are slightly younger than mine, but my eldest now starting to get some of the less PG stories. I'm like, and actually she listens to me more now. We're onto the less PG content. You can see her occasionally going, "You did what, Mum?" I'm like, yeah. I've been young and exciting, you know. But she, the stories have their time and they have their place, is what I mean seriously by that, not just joking. But, you know, the content that you might not share when they're younger sometimes becomes relevant later on and can save the day in a stressful situation. So, you know, it's all good stuff.
Absolutely, it's back to that from a safe place, isn't it? Because it's not going to be them if you're telling them your stories of when you've got into, because I tend to tell my daughter the stories of when I've got into trouble with this, or because she's 16 now, so she's kind of making that journey into womanhood, and now I'm laying on those stories, you know, like, oh, and then I did this, and you don't want to do that because this happened. She's like, you know, going pale, like, oh my goodness, no.
Oh no, so yours are the same age as mine then, roughly. Yeah, so that is we're into that one too. I'm just like, yeah. And also then you know that if you do get into a place that you shouldn't be in by accident or whatever, you know that actually your mum maybe knows.
Is that
bottom line is, honey, I have the t-shirt and
exactly. I know how this is going to turn out before it's even happened. From my story, my mum's stories of it, and yeah, absolutely, honestly.
Yeah, there's nothing new in the world, and I do know.
Yeah, I was going to come back. Don't they?
People are storytelling animals, so there you go. Stories are the thing that we need to keep us all bubbling safely along somehow.
Absolutely. I was going to ask you actually about, so coming back to, well, I guess like the more newer generation of witches, what advice you might offer to a witch who is perhaps new to working with herbs and plants as to where, if you were kind of starting out again, how would you begin with your journey, with your relationship with herbs and plants?
Ooh, really basic stuff, like, really, really basic stuff that I feel like everybody should know, but probably needs reiterating in the days of information being super accessible online, that you can't do better before you start thinking about anything more magical and esoteric, is you can't get past knowing what you're working with. So the first thing anyone should do really is get a really, really, really good book as opposed to just the app, because the app gets it wrong. But get a book, because book is backup. Have a basic understanding of the botany and the structure, because but do it in the field. So don't imagine that just the book and just the app are going to work. It doesn't matter where you are. You can be in an urban environment with, you know, birch trees planted by the council growing up in, you know, cages alongside the pavement, with dandelions trying to resist the weed killer, with buddleia sprouting out of a roof opposite your office. Engage with actual plants and an actual physical book that isn't just looking beautiful and magical, but is a really straightforward, good botanical guide that tells you what to look for, and then get the feel of them. But also smell and touch, and I am an open talking to plants mad plant person. I literally can be found wandering around a garden going, "Ooh, what are you? You're lovely." "Oh, look, aren't you beautiful?" Or squishing things to this day. And, you know, when I'm working with students, when I'm taking courses or workshops, I do, by the end of it, everyone's wandering around going, "Oh, hello, how are you this morning? You're lovely." And picking things and squeezing them and smelling them and, you know, risking tasting things. So get a good field guide, learn your basics. Actually, don't just do it by looking up on the internet and buying a bag of dried herbs on the internet and then going straight into thinking you're going to cast spells and heal acute illnesses. Get a really good basic. I mean, I say in the book, because I was aware that there is a lot of conversation amongst herbalists out with the sort of witchy community, practicing medicinal herbalists, that there's nothing worse than a herb book that doesn't offer you a really good idea and really good herbal information. And I've said, listen, I'm not going to do that, because I would say from the offset, I am a storyteller first and foremost. I'm a herbal storyteller. Yes, I've got training. Yes, I'm an associate member of the National Institute of Medical Herbalists. I am not a practicing clinical herbalist. I am not going to tell people what to look for. There are books better than mine that do that and do it really well. So get a really good herbal book. But unless you're prepared to go down the course of learning, doing a full course on medicinal herbalism, then stick to the, you know, a really well-written one. There's, you know, I could list loads of herb schools, but mainly in Scotland, I would go with Grassroots Remedies. And in England, there's Botanica School of Herbal Medicine, both of whom I know and trust. And in the US, there's Erica Gallantin, who is Sovereignty Herbs, all of whom I know personally, all of whom I know are turning out really solid courses on home herbal medicine practice that will give you the basics you need to know about how to create recipes, what simple herbs are safe to use for yourself, your children, your families. So I would inform yourself with that sort of thing. But first and foremost, get out there, listen to the plants. If you know they're safe, taste them gently, sit quietly and experience what they're doing inside your body. So start with things that are impossible to get wrong, I think, like dandelions or nettles. And, you know, make yourself a simple tea or buy something that you trust if that makes you feel more secure and if that's what you have access to. I realise some people are housebound. But experience the smell and the taste and sit quietly and think, what is this doing to me? Is my head clearing? How's my digestion feeling? If you want to go into a magical practice and then work, and if you feel more aligned to doing something more witchy, it's always best to have that as your root starting point before you start doing other stuff. In the book, that what I've encouraged people to do is find things that are mostly safe. I mean, oh gosh, I mentioned things like nettles and realized that people then might go and pick them in the autumn and give themselves, you know, some kind of trouble to their kidneys, or that people might be allergic to salicylates. And I've mentioned willow tea in there, but 99% of the time, the very small amount that you take will be pretty much safe for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And there are notes in the book if there is any kind of risk associated. But also, you know, you can't get better than experiencing them and smell and taste and touch and looking at them as your first step. And also go find someone that you know or that you trust that really resonates, that you feel like you want to work with, and go out with them. Go on a walk somewhere with them. you know, I take herbal storytelling walks. A lot of herbalists take walks, not necessarily for foraging, but just to introduce you to plants in the place and get a feel for them. And you can't get better than going out with someone that you feel like you can empathize with, that you feel like they resonate with you. You know, Do you know that feeling where it's just much more effective. There's no point in signing up for a course and then you spend the whole time going, oh my goodness, what is he going to say next? I'm so bored, and not looking at what you're doing. Find someone whose work you like. You know, you'll get the feel of a really good herbal book, or see someone who's social media you love and you really like them, and you're just like, I want to work with them, and then go and work with that person, even for just a day or a morning, and start to learn and experience things from there. But back it up with a good book.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think so many points in there you said are absolutely spot on. I love what you said about, you know, if it's like dandelions, avoiding, like, you know, just looking at what's growing where you are. I've not long moved to the countryside, but I've spent most of my life in South London, just come from the seaside, where, you know, there's not a lot there unless it's like you say, like planted by the council and so on. And yeah, I used to go out with my dog and just used to, every dog walk, like, used to go out and just look at what I could see. And I wasn't kind of like fixated on looking at fancy plants or whatever. I started off with like dandelions, and like that was like a whole new world. Like, the dandelion has millions of properties and magical associations. Yeah. You get so, like, it's so crazy, like, when you open up the world of that little plant that is just growing out the pavement, or like a little wallflower. And I think it's like often underestimated how magical what is just growing out there in a concrete jungle, or, yeah, just on the side of the road or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a whole sort of saying or a kind of beliefs amongst herbalists. Other sorts of practitioners who work with plants, that what we need grows where we are, so that plants have got a sort of a mycelial connection, if you like, with us that we're not aware of, or some of us aren't aware of, some people aren't aware of, but that the plants reflect this. And so that if you question those dandelions, and as you say, they've got so many uses, but they survive most of the things that people throw at them. There's a wonderful Scottish story about their connection to fairyland, which I'll share with you another time. But they've got really fabulous effect on the liver, and sort of liver toxicity is such a common thing in modern environments. You know, too much booze, all those other things can unfortunately affect our livers. And there you go, outside any licensed establishment within a couple of paces, there will be dandelions growing.
Yeah.
but yeah, plants are there where we need them. You know, I as you say, even our city, inner city canals or waterways, and you go for a dog walk and you'll pass hawthorn growing with its berries that heal broken hearts, and can be used to, you know, dispel grief, or and also have a wonderful effect on the blood pressure, another symptom of modern life, you know. And so plants are there when we need them, and you know, you can either be in a beautifully rich botanical environment, which I'm lucky enough to be in these days, but like you, spent a lot of time in city environments where there wasn't much, but they're still there, you know, they're still popping up around us.
Absolutely. I'm a real huge, so I, ever since I was a kid, like, I always had really crippling, like, depression, when it was uncool to say that you were like mentally unwell, you know, when you would get the kick, like, you would get the crap kicked out of you at school if you said you were depressed or whatever. That was like, you know, for me growing up in the 80s and the 90s. And so I've always kind of struggled with that, especially when I was living in London, because I loved London, but I very much struggled with like the concrete jungle aspect of it. And for me, like when I started to kind of look at plants and herbs and so on, even being there, it did open up this other little world of escapism for me, because it did feel like, oh, there is a bit of nature on the doorstep. I was coming back to you, sorry, talking about the depression link. You mentioned about hawthorn and so on, and I actually work with a herbal medicine practitioner. And for me, like, that's been such an integral part, along with lots of therapy, of like my depression journey and like coming out of my like Virginia Woolf mode, as I call it, because she absolutely got it. And like, you know, with the herbs that she gave me, what they linked to and so on. And I just think that these little plants and these herbs, you know, when you say hawthorn, these things that they're just growing on the side of a road, or they could just be growing in a big urban city. They are integral parts of this medicine that can, you know, can help with depression and all sorts of different ailments that we've got. I just think it's so magical how they can be used. And this kind of, I always used to assume that you wouldn't be able to treat like how I felt with herbs, that they weren't strong enough. But then I remember thinking, well, you know, if you've got like ayahuasca, you've got like cocaine, marijuana, like, not that I'm promoting any drug use, but I used to think, look at the huge impacts and effects that they have on people. How can you underestimate these plants together to treat you in a healing way?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it goes back to that thing where I having gone through depression myself as well. So, you know, really resonated with me what you just said. I found that pharmaceutical antidepressants, actually one or two of them, made me feel worse. Absolutely horrific side effects. And the, you know, St. John's wort, for example, is basically one of the best serotonin reuptake inhibitors that there is. And it works for me personally. When I was coming out of that period, it's described as, you know, being a light antidepressant. I found it more powerful than anything in a pharmacy. You know, like someone had switched on some kind of beautiful sunset in the back of my head and made everything change quite quickly. I say to people who say to me, oh, I've got something that can't be treated. Yeah, I'm never going to tell people I take allopathic Western medicine as well as use herbal medicine. I use the two alongside each other. There are some things that will save your life, you know, antibiotics being the simplest one. Because the action is so fast, although, you know, intense amounts of garlic or garlic and echinacea or thyme may be more beneficial in the long term, may also sometimes be better than the antibiotics. But there are, let's face it, there are some illnesses that if you don't have modern medicine, you are not going to be here next week. However, there are some things where herbs are gentler, more effective, and have fewer side effects. You know, there is that's why we need clinical herbalists, because you know, this is not necessarily a path of self-treatment for everybody. I always say to people, you know, get someone, because a proper medical herbalist will sit down and do an individual, very, very detailed medical history, profile all your symptoms, and therefore be able to treat you appropriately. But at the same point, there are some things that are really easy to access and that you have in your cupboard or your garden or in the, you know, hedgerow near your house that can also be as strong and sometimes in some circumstances more appropriate than the pharmaceutical equivalent. The other thing is, of course, is that you can't escape, is that a pharmacy, a chemist is full of things that are derived from from plants. You know, I mean, aspirin is salicylic acid, which we get from meadowsweet and from willow. one of the first incredibly powerful heart medicines was developed from digitoxin, which is foxglove, deadly poisonous if you go around munching on them in the wild. But if a pharmacy hadn't got involved in that one, it wouldn't have become a mainstay of the medical practice. Although I do tell a lovely story about a woman who had that recipe taken from her, but that's maybe for another episode. I think that we are also, Britain and the US are two of the few places where pharmacies don't have a huge range of herbal products available to the pharmacist and the apothecary. I did a workshop a couple of years ago now, and the in the audience, it was a family workshop, but it had a lot of grown-ups came as well as children, and the grown-ups had some really interesting conversations. One of the ones that I've heard repeated on a number of occasions since was with a Polish woman who had trained as a apothecary, as a pharmacist, and in Poland, and she said, I was so relieved to come to your workshop today. I give you the heads up. This workshop was in a massive medical teaching place, and they wanted me to create a public workshop sharing some of their historical aspects, some of their exhibition of historical medicine with the public. And so there was Lister's early discussions, early experiments with antiseptics. There were developments, shall we say, in modern medicine there, alongside my conversations about herbs and herbal storytelling. And this apothecary from Poland said to me, when I learned 10 years ago, we learned about herbs as well as about Western medicine. And in my pharmacy back in Poland, I had both on the shelves, and I could treat people with either willow or with aspirin. I had those options available. Wow. To me. And when I came here, I was really surprised to find that your chemists do not have that stuff to hand. And I've had a similar conversation with an Italian chemist just a few weeks ago. And so we are quite unique, shall we say, that we don't have that range of medicines available to us. And certainly the US is on another step in that scale of separation from herbs to pharmaceuticals. And I think that's a shame, because I think having the knowledge and both to hand can really save a lot more lives and bring about a lot more integrated health options that are appropriate for different people at different times. Yeah. I mean, I think, having started this conversation mentioning depression, I think herbs are one of the great unsung heroes in treating sort of a range of quite upsetting and life damaging mental health conditions. They're not the answer to everything, but they do offer a really strong helping hand to a lot of people that shouldn't be underestimated.
Something you said about when you were given prescribed medication, like NHS and so on, I really resonated with that. I used to feel like hopeless, that I was never going to find anything that was going to make me feel better. Because I had friends that, I've seen other people take it and that it worked for them. But for me, I always felt like I was inside, and this medication was the sort of exterior mask, but I was still inside feeling rubbish, just really dosed up and out of it. And I genuinely lost any hope with ever kind of taking anything that balanced me out. And again, like you were saying, the whole experience of working with herbs and using it as my daily medicine in different ways, teas and tinctures and so on. Absolute game changer for me, because it set a foundation. And this is kind of why I'm bringing it up, Amanda, because I feel like there might be a lot of people listening that are like, I'm not getting anywhere with the typical NHS route. I'm not bashing the NHS, but maybe that typical route that is so, you know, the society's kind of like norm. I just think if ever you fail, like if you struggled with that, if you felt it's failed you, do have a look at how you can work with herbs, because absolute game changer for me. And it set a foundation with my nervous system where mm-hmm. I then got into therapy and could talk about stuff that I'd spent, I mean, I'm 41 now and I'd spent 20 something years of never ever discussing, but it set this foundation in my body with my yeah. nervous system that I could then do the work without thinking I was going to die. I used to think I was going to die if I spoke about certain things. And it's amazing yeah. when you get the two interacting, or even if you were just trying herbal things and then began, you know, it might give you the prompt to start shadow work or just whatever the healing form is. It leads on to other things. It was a life changer for me.
Absolutely. And I'm with you there. I mean, I slightly different experience in that I would say it felt like herbs had my back, if that makes yeah. sense. Really, really, that they were supportive, that they held me, basically, because I would say that most of my dramas, my lack of confidence, my depression, my depression came from a lack of confidence. And I'd made bad choices because of that lack of confidence, because I was incredibly frightened. I just spent a lot of time frightened of something that I didn't know what it was. I still get it occasionally. I still have to remember, you know, go back. You need to just sit down and breathe deeply and not resent reminding yourself to breathe deeply and sip tea and, you know, imagine yourself safe and it will come back to you. But it was panic attacks with me, absolutely shocking fear. And then, you know, hoping that other people that weren't necessarily going to help me, or work that wasn't going to help me, would somehow alleviate this fear or save me from it somehow. Do you know? Maybe that's where fairy stories come in, because I think maybe not Handsome Prince, although probably there were ideas about Handsome Princes too, to be honest. I'll be honest. I thought that maybe a relationship was going to be the, you know, the brave thing that saved me. I didn't find the brave person that's got my back until I actually found my own bravery. You know what I mean? I didn't need to be saved, because I had to tick that box. But then someone that would save me appeared. But because I wouldn't like to discredit my lovely other half, because he's totally got my back. But it wasn't until I'd done that work myself that opened up. But yeah, herbs had my back and made me brave enough. Now, that sounds ridiculous when I'm someone who's, you know, been telling you that I'm happy to travel off somewhere on my own and stand up in a room of, you know, I've worked with a couple of hundred people in the audience, or 10 people in a more intimate workshop setting, and talk about confidently about what I do and what I know about. But it's because of working with herbs and that change in my nervous system, my thought patterns, and my state of mind that allowed me to be the thing that makes me happy. I also think that, you know, the whole getting out there and familiarizing yourself with plants, probably, you know, I know there is some wonderful research being done now about the effect on microbiome and, you know, touching soil and plants and things yeah. will affect your internal microbiome. And that as well is massively supportive to not only physical health, but your mental and emotional state as well. And so I really think the idea of forest bathing or walking is out in nature is just touching the surface. It's also vital, don't get me wrong, you know, that going out, but you can walk and observe those dandelions and that hawthorn and the hedges and the buddleia on the rooftop, but, you know, touching it, smelling it, tasting it, and getting used to it, and then finding which plants work for you is just, it's more than just simply being in nature. It's layers and layers of stuff, and it's all those things we've talked about, those intergenerational relationships and sharing of recipes and plant ID and childhood memories. It's the fairy stories the plants grow into. It's the folklore that's been handed down over the centuries, spoken word charms, little rhymes, little tiny increments of magic. It just all works together, and it's a really, really vital part of healthy life individually and as a society, I guess, really. I've just made it sound like something really deep and important is happening, but do you know what? I mean, I can hear the passion for this in your voice as well. I really, really passionately believe that this is an incredibly important thing. And I'm just very, very lucky. I'm very grateful that I found a place in it that I can add my voice, my work to that general sense that there's this big important thing, you know, because everything comes into it, doesn't it? You know, sustainability, how whether or not the planet survives our greed, if you like,
and our presence,
for resources, you know, all of it, it all fits in there somewhere.
I'm so grateful that you shared some of your vulnerable stories on this as well, because I really, really relate, and I'm sure so many of the listeners will relate to you saying, like, because I completely relate to that. It's only when you've, like, saved yourself that you are a magnet to the people that are going to, you know, does that make sense? Of, like,
totally.
Because some of these stories, you know, some of the stories can affect us quite negatively and give us these beliefs, and we don't realize that we are the one that's going to be on our own horse charging in with a sword and doing that for us, you know. So yeah. I think that's really important. I'm really glad that you shared that, because I really resonate with that, and I think a lot of other people will too. When you save yourself, it's amazing, like, all the things that kind of come as a result of that, and I really resonated with that. I wanted to ask you, we've talked a lot about the medicinal side and the law.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always really curious about other, you know, witchy, pagan, spiritual types, and, you know, how they work in their practice. So I wanted to ask you what the last question is, really, what herbs that you like to work with most in regards to your spiritual practice and how you work with them?
Right, I will. So I'm not, I don't have a title under which I put all that, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm find religious and spiritual practices, I think they're really important, but I'm almost got a sort of slightly, I've got an anthropologist's fascination with it. So I like, I love finding out what other people do. What I do personally is probably deeply personal and feels quite, it doesn't feel like it's got anything to sit under. It's just what I do.
Yeah.
So what do I do? I have an awful lot of that sitting and observing and tasting actually then becomes a spiritual, if you like, process. And if I feel like I need to do that to maintain my connection, I become a better storyteller. I work with people more effectively and have a much nicer time, and they enjoy it a lot more. And it all becomes something much more beautiful and grows, and it feels connected to something beyond mere humanity, beyond the the tactile beyond the things we can hold if I put in that time sitting with plants. And although I do have one or two sort of touchstone plants that I need to return to, I also do it whenever I discover a new story or I hear a snippet of history, the plant that it is, I make sure that I take that and have that time with the plant so that I understand it before I share it with other people. And that, I think, has become a, it's not, people say, is that how you work as a storyteller? It's more than that. It is an actual working practice that has rhythm and a deeper connection to something else. I'm not really being very lucid about this. I mean, I feel like I'm usually quite...
No, I love
but
that.
It is really deeply personal, and it's just kind of like, it's something about sitting, being with, listening to the effect on the body. Those things that I touched on when we talked about how do you start your practice are still the core aspect of my practice. And then when I take that and when I chat to people or when I do something to create a certain there is an aspect to most of my stories that have like a hidden realm, if you like, that I know and that I see. And some people, I think I tried to get that into the book. It's interesting trying to do that into a written work. But certainly when I'm running a workshop, I've worked with those plants so that I can almost create another realm of the plant because of the work I've done with it and with the story. And as I imagine and hold that, that becomes sort of redolent, if you like, to the audience. Which, yeah, it's quite hard to talk about. I don't know. I work with plants in a number of ways, and I work with them in stories, and then I hold that and I bring it into the session. So I'm never just, I mean, there are wonderful storytellers and practitioners who will say serve a herbal tea whilst they're telling a story, and they're doing their own thing. What I'm doing is not just having a cup of tea with a story. That plant, you know, I will take an essence of it. I will take, the essence will have scented. I can't even tell you because I'm not prepared to share all of them.
No, I absolutely get it.
But you know what? I do a load of stuff and I bring it another dimension of it into the room because I really don't think, I mean, I studied Goethe a lot when I was studying herbal medicine. I don't think you can experience a herb in a simple one-dimensional form. You need to completely immersed yourself into that story, into that herb, and then you need to embody it and bring it out. And so I spend a degree of my personal time putting that into practice in the background so that I know what I'm doing when I'm in the room with other people. So that I think is probably the core of my own practice, because that's you know what, with sharing it with other people, that is what brought me into this and made, you know, healed all those aspects of my life that we've touched on. So if I meet obstacles, and so I need to always remember to go back and do that.
I love that so much. And it is just like, kind of, you know, it makes me think of all the plants being their own little like devas and having their own little personalities, and you're just connecting directly with them, and you've done all that work with them over the years. Your relationships, you know, they are really strong as a result, and I think that's truly magical. And I'm really grateful. Oh my goodness, Amanda, you have no idea how truly fascinated I have been by what you've talked about today. I feel like there's so many conversations we've got into, and again, I've been hanging on your every word because you are such a storyteller. I can't wait to see what you do next. And on that note, before we kind of wrap things up, because I know I've kept you a long time, but I could have you talking all day, what are you sort of what have you got going on at the moment that you want to share? Like, where can we find you? What do we need to know about what's next?
Oh, thank you so much. And it's been really lovely talking to you too. I feel like you're a friend now. I'm like, oh, I love this again.
I've loved it.
But yeah, what am I doing? Well, I am, this is my, kind of my last work bit. I'm about to take the last postings of the book and things out to people this afternoon. But then actually what I'm doing is I've just released The Forest Path, which is my first online herbal storytelling course that touches on some of the things we've talked about. So that's out. That's available online on my website, Botanica Fabula. But I'm just finishing off the next chapter of the Very Curious Herbal online courses. So that's coming out later on this week. So people can find those on my website. They can also, if anyone's listening from near the northeast of America, I'm super excited. I'm going to be in very, very beautiful Hudson Valley, wow, in upstate New York, for Imolc, for Candlemas, St. Bride's Day, or just Bridie's Day, the Feast of St. Bridget. And I am doing a wonderful weekend retreat in a beautiful working farm, Metaby in upstate New York. Yeah, we'll be there all weekend. We'll be walking and looking at plants just as I've described. We'll be having stories, some food. There will be creating. Bridie is the, or Bridget is the patron saint of poetry, apart from anything else. And healing, and so we will be working with herbs and creating some magical stories and tastes and expanding our knowledge of those vital, vibrant springtime herbs that like bring us out of winter and into, you know, that lovely time of year. I love spring, and it's just beginning to creep in a bit. So there'll be a bit of Scottish traditional folk lore in there, some of origin stories, how that creeps into early Christian beliefs. There will be folklore, there will be storytelling, there will be herbs, there will be creating. Yeah, and then I'm back in Scotland the end of the first week in February, doing things for the National Library of Scotland. So there's lots going on, but if anyone does want to find out more, I will share a link to my website. And I'm all over social media. So do please, anyone, get in touch. I am as friendly as I seem when I'm chatting away to Carly. I'm kind of deeply personal and hide away quite a lot, but then people talk to me and I'm a complete chatterbox, as you might have gathered. So yeah, I was gonna say happening. That.
No, not that you, I weren't going to say you're a chatterbox. I was going to say, I probably shouldn't say this, but of all the authors I've had on the show, you are the warmest, like most down to earth. Like you were saying earlier, if you find someone that you resonate with and you want to study with, like honestly, Amanda is exactly how she comes across, you know, yes, off interview. So if you want to, you know, what a person to learn from, genuinely. So everything that you've given, like I'll put everything in the show notes so you can find Amanda. But thank you so much for coming on. I'm so grateful.
Oh, thank you, Carly. It's been absolutely lovely talking to you. Thank you so much. And thank you for loving the book. I mean, just it's been a really lovely morning chatting.
That is all I have for you today, witches. If you happen to love Amanda's work as much as I do, you may wish to sign up to her new course, The Silk Roads, and use the code Silk Roads, no space, all in capitals, which will give you 25% off until the new year. I will link the codes and all the details for Amanda's course, book, website, and socials in the show notes so that you can find her. I just want to say a big thank you to all my Patreons. Without you guys, I could not do this. If you would like more witchy content, you can sign up to the Witches Institute for just £6 per month. For that, you will get access to Patreon podcast episodes, meditations, folklore retellings, hedge witch studies where we look at power animals, crystals, trees, plants. We also have our witchy community and lots of other witchy extras. You can cancel at any time. Have a wonderful new year, witches, and I will catch up with you all soon, sending you lots and lots of witchy love.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.